Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. I'm Caroline Bryant, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Today, we are excited to host this webinar on infrastructure and the telecommunications space. Our moderator today is Danielle Boomen. Danielle is Senior Counsel for Chairman Brendan Carr at the FCC. She rejoins Commissioner Carr following a year in the private sector, where she led on state and local government relations matters for a nationwide telecommunications infrastructure provider. Before her stint with Commissioner Carr, Danielle was an associate attorney in the Washington, D.C. office of WBK. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers and moderator, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. After our panel gives their presentations, we will turn to you, the audience, for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federalist Society. With that, Danielle, thank you so much for joining us, and the floor is yours.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Caroline, for the introductions, and thank you to the Federalist Society for having us for this conversation today. I'd like to kick it off by having each of you introduce yourselves and give a very brief 45-second to a minute overview of your company or your association's interest in broadband siting issues. And I'll just kind of go around my screen. So Caroline Van Wee, you're in my upper left corner, and I'll start with you.
Thanks so much, Danielle. Hey, everybody. I'm Caroline Van Wee. I'm a vice president at AT&T. The focus of my work is on mostly on wireline and some wireless issues for AT&T, working with the Federal Communications Commission around regulations that impact our company. I think our interest in broadband infrastructure should be self-evident. We are providing wireless and fixed broadband internet connections across 21 states in the country, and hope to continue to expand that footprint going forward.
Awesome. Thank you. All right. Next, Paul.
Hi, Danielle. Well, thank you for moderating this panel, and thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting it. I work as a vice president for regulatory and corporate affairs at Cogeco. You might not be familiar with the name. Cogeco is a Canadian-based cable company with activities both in Canada and the U.S. In the U.S., we operate under the BreezeLine brand name, and we cover a regional footprint that encompasses 600 communities in 13 states. So essentially, we're mostly on the East Coast, and our footprint spans from Maine to Miami. We're also present in the Midwest with some cable systems in Ohio. We're obviously very interested in this discussion. We serve smaller markets, and we invest annually over $250 million to connect new communities and upgrade our networks. Our focus is really what I would call the backbone of America. We focus on populations that sometimes have been forgotten by the larger competitors. And the issue of obstacles to deployment is obviously very important to us. We're a smaller player. If you look at the 13 states we're into, we're present in very small pockets of these states. So we're not that big. And the impact that regulations and obstacles of deployment has on us can be significant. So we're obviously looking forward to the work being done by the current administration to remove barriers, drive innovation and investment in broadband networks. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Thanks, Paul. And next to you, Tony.
Hi, Danielle, and hello to all. My name is Tony Clark. I'm executive director of NARUC, which is the National Association of Regulatory Utility Commissioners. It's the organization that represents the 50 state utility commissions across the country, D.C., several of the U.S. territories. In terms of our association's interests and the interests of state commissions, it's evolved a bit over time. 20 years ago, when I first joined a public utility commission, I was a commissioner on the North Dakota PSC for 12 years and then a commissioner at FERC after that. But I mean, when I first started in the early 2000s, telecom might have been almost majority of the work that state commissions were doing. It was post 96 Telecom Act, 271 proceedings, certificating CLECs. There was sort of all sorts of activity at the states. It's evolved a little bit over time, but still a number of areas where states have a particular interest. NARUC for a long time has had standing policy in support of removing barriers to the build out of broadband deployment. And there's still some discrete areas where states play an important role. Things like pole attachments frequently come before the states, right-of-way issues in certain instances come before the states, as well as some general kind of broadband deployment access issues, which sometimes are shared by state broadband offices and in some cases by state commissions. In all cases, it's the situation where states are usually relatively close to the customers who are being served. And so oftentimes will fill a facilitation role regardless of the actual statutory jurisdictional obligations that each state commission has, which vary a little bit by state to state.
All right, great. So I thought we'd start the discussion by focusing on NEPA. The Trump administration over the last 3 months has issued, I would say a handful, but that's an underestimate of the number of executive orders that impact the telecom space, including an executive order that directed CEQ to propose rescinding its NEPA regulations and to also provide guidance on implementing NEPA in light of some of the amendments that were made to the statute by Congress back in 2023. In the guidance that CEQ subsequently issued, agencies were told to revise their NEPA implementing procedures to not only expedite permitting approvals, but to make their implementing procedures more consistent following the 2023 Fiscal Responsibility Act. So just recently, we saw that CTIA filed a petition at the FCC requesting that the FCC, in light of the executive order and the congressional actions in 2023, update our implementing procedures. That is out on public notice for comment right now. What are you guys expecting to see filed in response to that petition and that public notice? And how do you think that this could be impactful for NARUC and for Breezeline and AT&T? And Caroline, I'll start with you guys, and Paul and Tony, if you guys want to jump in, feel free.
Yeah, I mean, I think from a practical perspective, the FCC has done a good job of having sort of a clear processes around NEPA and NERA. But it is, these are, you know, steps that we have to go through every single time that we are, you know, building a tower, expanding our wireless footprint, sometimes even in certain cases, co-locating under certain circumstances that, you know, creates a lot of paperwork and, you know, expense associated with doing that. I think we, you know, from a practical perspective, typically have to hire a specialist contractor to review, you know, every site, go through a list of, you know, questionnaires to figure out like how does this fall within the NEPA rules? What do we have to do? How does it, you know, and the same with NERA. You know, I think that it's a great opportunity right now for the FCC to look at its rules, particularly the NEPA rules in light of the petition filed by CTIA, and really think about how that aligns with the Fiscal Responsibility Act that came out in 2023 from Congress, which clarified that the NEPA rules, you know, apply to major federal actions. And I think that the question that CTIA poses, that's an important one, is, you know, whether a geographic, large geographic license is actually a major federal action as it relates to the building of towers. So because you have the ability to use a license in a particular geographic area, and there's no direction from the commission or oversight really of the commission on how you design the antenna network that supports the provision of that spectrum and the use of that spectrum, you know, is that a major federal action? I think CTIA makes a strong argument that it's not. And I think, you know, taking aligning those rules with the congressional mandate here will help simplify and speed lower costs for broadband and wireless expansion. And then I think, you know, you know, as we are looking at, you know, expanding a pipeline of spectrum in the future, you know, these rules immediately will help us densify faster and get better coverage, you know, tomorrow when we are sort of looking at reforming the rules. But in the long run, as we're looking at, you know, building this out, the spectrum pipeline, getting more commercial spectrum into the marketplace, which we all know we need to be able to compete with China, all those things, getting these rules right now will help us be ready to speed the deployment of that spectrum when we're ready to go. So I think it's a great opportunity for the commission to look at this and align it with the FRA.
Great. Paul, Tony, anything that you guys want to add or anything that you anticipate seeing?
Not really from my perspective. So BreezeLine does not operate licensed wireless facilities, so we're not really affected and subject to requirements under NEPA. When I saw this question, I was trying to think of something else that I could mention on environmental requirements. And we do experience them at the state and local levels. And this is an issue that has sprung up a lot. And just in trying to find a kind of salient example to provide to the crowd of multiple listeners who are here today, I was recently speaking to some of our folks who operate on the eastern shore of Maryland, and you know, just one example of how environmental regulations can very much slow down infrastructure deployment is there's a very complex web of local, state, and federal regulations that pertain to wetlands. This is just one example amongst many others where we've had in a lot of the counties in Maryland where we operate to sometimes apply for these permits. And sometimes we don't even need to pass the wetland, we just need to pass around it, but it's close enough to trigger the permit application process. And these permits can take a lot of time in order to be fully processed and granted. There's very often some unexpected costs involved with the issuance of the permits, a variety of authorities. We recently had to wait a year and a half to get a denial of a permit requirement, which we still do not fully understand. So obviously, these are elements of friction that we find extremely troublesome. And this is not to say that environmental regulations are not warranted, but streamlining of permitting processes and better predictability is something that would go a lot for us, because not only in certain instances we need to face a decision to spend more to connect in another way, sometimes we just have to stop the project because it doesn't make sense anymore. And there should be a threshold in terms of low impact, or let's be honest, no impact projects, where at the very least, under a certain threshold of impact, there is a much more speedy way to get where you want to be.
Great, thank you.
So just a few thoughts. I mean, first, sometimes folks will ask me, what's NARUC's position on X? And I'll say, what's Congress's position on X? And the answer is probably as many viewpoints as you have in Congress, there's similar viewpoints in NARUC. So I suspect with regard specifically to the CEQ interim rule, NARUC itself hasn't taken a position on the February interim rule and hasn't been asked to comment on it. And as I said, I'm pretty sure there are differences of opinions within the association. But speaking for me, having dealt with NEPA a lot more candidly on the energy side than the communication side, but it's sort of flows from the same statute, and each of these networked industries sees the same issues. So I'm not a lawyer, but like I said, I've had a lot of experience with it, especially at FERC, but also at the state level. If you look at the NEPA text to the casual reader, it's pretty clear that it truly is a process statute. There's no substantive outcome that is supposed to be driven from it necessarily. And as long as the agency is faithfully taking a hard look at potential impacts, it's fulfilled its statutory obligation. But what we have seen time and again is that sort of hook increasingly can be used as a cudgel to try to block infrastructure projects that may be needed. In some cases, even the state itself believes that the project is needed. As I said on the former state commissioner, we saw it on the state side for sure. For example, in the transmission space, where you would have projects that would You know, the shortest distance between two lines is a straight, or between two points is a straight line. And you'd see a transmission project that was proposed to go in. And rather than taking that shortest distance that was most economical to take and could be permitted the fastest, you would see sort of crazy siting decisions. And you'd look into why these decisions were being made. It was to avoid federal NEPA nexus and to avoid triggering federal involvement in the project, even though, I mean, we weren't talking about national monuments and national parks. These were truly multi-use federal lands, grasslands where there's cattle grazing and roads and oil pads and all kinds of things. But infrastructure development companies would avoid those to avoid any sort of NEPA analysis. And that speaks not only to cost and efficiency and speed, but you're taking projects that really are ideally suited for public land and putting them on private land and going through private takings because of it. So it causes all sorts of issues. And then on the federal side, I saw it at FERC for certain where agency is sort of held almost fly-specking standards sometimes by litigants who can use what I would call abuse of NEPA as it's evolved over time. Again, it applies a lot in the energy world. It applies equally to communications providers who are looking to build out infrastructure in a similar way.
That's great. And I think the point that you're making about abuse of the statute meshes well with my next question for you guys, which is National Historic Preservation Act and the way that historic properties and historic areas have at times abused that designation in order to either block projects or delay projects quite significantly. The FCC over the last few years, we've implemented NPAs and streamlined review requirements to simplify the Section 106 review process. But we continue to hear about delays in historic areas. And even when I was in the private sector for an infrastructure company for 1 year, I encountered this quite a bit, including in some of our most beautiful historic cities in some of our southern region. So tell me a little bit about how NHPA is slowing down deployment and what steps you think that agencies, including the FCC, could take to help mitigate these issues. And then separate from that, in the absence of a consistent federal landscape post deregulation, do you expect to see kind of states fill that vacuum and localities fill that vacuum, not just on NHPA, but Paul, you were talking about state and local environmental processes as well. Like, I'm interested in, is all of this deregulation at the national level, which is going to be incredibly good for investment and opportunity and cutting red tape, are we going to have to then battle these battles at the state and local level next? Whoever wants to jump in first, Ken.
I'm happy to start. So on NHPA, we're again not subject to these requirements, but I think the point that you raised, Danielle, is a very good one where overall, we are seeing this more deregulatory trajectory at the federal level, which we're fully supportive of and looking forward to working with the administration to see how we can ensure that the climate for investment in broadband is as good as it can be. What we are seeing, however, is as you seem to mention there, the more deregulatory trajectory that we're seeing at the federal level may be seen as a void at the state and municipal levels, where states are coming in and deciding to regulate our activities themselves. This is not really infrastructure related, but for instance, the low-cost broadband options that we're seeing burgeoning in various states right now, because some people think that the void at the federal level allows them to do this. And as I was mentioning before, as a smaller provider with that lacks scale, but still is present in 13 states, for us having to deal with a patchwork of different requirements from state to state and locality to locality, when we don't necessarily have the resources on the compliance front to look after all of these requirements, is a big issue. We're seeing on the permitting issue, we're seeing some municipalities sometimes asking for an engineering stamp on every single permit that we are hoping to get. On de minimis issues like a street crossing, there's a town in Ohio that wants us to pay a few thousand to an engineering firm so that they can certify that we're able to do this. Obviously, this raises our costs significantly. And it's also interesting that we're doing this in the context of the BEAD program being progressively rolled out. Obviously, the administration might make some tweaks to it, but I think that there's also fear that a lot of uncertainty with respect to some of these permitting make-ready fees that people might require will dull some of the business plans, dull the incentives that providers have to deploy, will significantly alter the viability of their plans. And this is something that, in our view, to the extent that the FCC can intervene, it can intervene in many ways to ensure that, again, all the work that's being done at the federal level to ensure and facilitate the deployment doesn't get essentially kiboshed because of lower administrations taking over and establishing their own rules, certainly is something that we would support.
Caroline, Tony, anything you guys want to add?
Sure. I think, you know, as much as I know that there's you know, the open proceeding on NEPA, I think, NERA, there's an opportunity here to also think more about how those rules can be streamlined. I think, you know, there are some different, it's a different situation because the CEQ and the executive order are really focused on some of the NEPA issues, but there's so much overlap between those two regimes that it feels like it could be a good opportunity to continue to align them. And, you know, I think from our perspective, some things that could be improved there, it would certainly be nice if, you know, we had additional clarity around sort of how we interact with the tribes during the NEPA review process, sort of where, you know, how they participate, where and when compensation is appropriate, where it's not appropriate, I think is always helpful. And I think also, you know, trying to align the NEPA rules with sort of the character of the historic location even more closely. An example I always think of is, I have there's a restaurant in my neighborhood that is, you know, a former gas station. And it was like the first gas station when you drove into the District of Columbia. And so it's been protected under historic preservation rules so that the plot and the land area sort of still has that frontage that looks like a gas station. And that's a historic building, right? And yet it faces Massachusetts Avenue, which has lots of infrastructure running up and down it, towers visible. And so, you know, taking into account the sort of infrastructure and vantage point from that building, you know, it's looking on lots of, you know, city infrastructure. And so just balance, having some balance there, you know, and making sure that we are not overimposing historic preservation rules in areas that are already, you know, in areas that have lots of infrastructure and in which infrastructure is not going to be detrimental to the experience of being in that place.
So I would only add that, the issue, which sort of crossed across NEPA and the NHPA, whether triggering a major federal action or federal undertaking, depending on the statute. Historically, it's been a problem in a number of areas, but especially coming from a rural state, it's oftentimes especially been difficult for rural broadband providers and rural telephony providers, because you often have in areas like that no choice but to extend fiber in ways that either trigger a railroad crossing or some portion of federal land, and then it sort of trips up the entire project in that process. So the streamlining of that, I think, would be extremely helpful. And I think from a state standpoint would probably be welcome, although sometimes fingers are pointed at states and local governments for holding things up. Having served on the state side a long time, I can tell you that oftentimes it's the states who point back at federal statutes and say, look, if the feds can streamline theirs first, it would do an enormous amount for us to help bring broadband and get broadband deployed more ubiquitously. There's a number of things that we're looking at in, you know, that could be potentially helpful in Congress. I note that Congressman Fulcher from Idaho last year introduced the Reducing Barriers for Broadband on Federal Lands Act. It didn't go anywhere. It's been reintroduced, I think, in this session, and you know, who knows what the prospects or something like that are. It always helps get attached to some other piece of legislation, but basically it would create if there's been previously disturbed land or property that infrastructure is trying to go across, it would create a categorical exclusion for that, which it's, so there are ideas like this out there to help on the federal side. And I think whatever happens there necessarily helps out on the state side. And for those states and localities that have sort of reformed in a similar way, it means that broadband deployment is going to flow there first, which offers an incentive for them to get the incentive structure right as well.
Sure, that makes sense. Yeah, federal land siting continues to be, you know, an issue that is raised across every administration. I know it was a really big problem that I think was addressed in part under the first Trump administration, but we continue to hear, if not daily, at least weekly, about challenges on federal lands and the tribal engagement, tribal consultation process as well. You know, particularly, you know, North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota, there's, you know, certain states where because of the large swaths of tribal lands and federal lands further west, you know, to the extent that we could really see some type of comprehensive streamlining across the federal government. My boss has called for over the last 7 years, I think since he first became a commissioner, for some type of single, you know, federal land siting desk where all of your permitting is going through a single entry point to try to streamline and organize a little bit more efficiently. But we're excited to see what comes down the pike on that front. I know a lot of, you know, eyes are paying attention to what may come out of the Hill or come out of the White House on federal siting.
Danielle, we'll just add with tribal siting, I mean, it's something that's in the state's interest as well. They want early consultation with the tribes. And that's really the key, is to create that venues for early consultation so that you can have that input into the process early on. What I think is frustrating, probably both for the tribes and for state and local government, is when there's sort of objections raised late in a project that then requires you to have to go back in, dig through the record, and it really kind of starts it all the clock from scratch. And that, I think, is frustrating for the infrastructure developer as well as each level of government.
Great. So talked about this a little bit, but under the first Trump administration, Chairman Pai took significant measures to streamline infrastructure deployment, mostly or particularly for small cell deployment. So what next? What are some of the biggest challenges? We talked federal land siting. You guys have talked a little bit about some of the challenges you're seeing at the state and local level. But, you know, give me the top one or two challenges that each of you guys are seeing. You know, Paul, you in particular, you know, and Caroline, you too. I'm also a wireline person, so I feel like we have, you know, the wireline team here. Tell me what you're seeing. What are the challenges that you think we should be focused on the most over the next few years?
I'm happy to start. So I would say three things, right? There's make ready costs for poles, there's pole replacement costs, and there's state and local permitting obstacles. First of all, I can say as a general matter, we're optimistic about the administration and the trajectory it's taking, and we're looking forward to working with it to achieve these goals. And we feel that the previous administration sometimes did not appear to appreciate the significant challenges with deploying a network, whether it's with respect to permitting requirements or pole and conduit access, contractor availability, and also different legal requirements that can vary from state to state. So we are confident that Chairman Carr understands these challenges and is going to put things on a better track moving forward. On make ready, We feel like this issue hasn't received a lot of attention from the FCC, especially make ready costs that aren't directly related to attaching. So things like engineering studies, application fees that pole owners demand from broadband providers, these can really add up quickly and change business cases. I can give you one example. BreezeLine recently had to abandon a county-funded grant in the town of Cumberland, Maryland, where the utility company proposed almost $250,000 in pole permitting, engineering, and make-ready costs for what amounted to a 2.2-mile project that would have connected 34 homes. So in terms of what the FCC can do, Section 224 of the Communications Act does provide the FCC with a broad grant of authority to establish some guardrails, in our view, in this area to bring down costs and speed up the process. And we recognize that utilities are entitled to recover their costs, but they should not be able to profit off make-ready applications and fees. So for instance, one recommendation that we would make is for the FCC to make the determination that application fees are not reasonable if they exceed the utility's cost to review applications. Or the FCC could require that utilities cannot force providers to pay for additional engineering studies when a provider has already submitted one with their application. On the issue of the pole replacement cost, you know, this is an issue that the FCC is very well aware of. All too often, pole owners are taking advantage of broadband providers in order to pay for new poles. The FCC has provided some helpful guidance on the matter to try to limit this behavior and to ensure that broadband providers are not forced to pay for the full cost of pole replacements. But the reality is, way too often we do face the prospect of doing so, and we have no real ability to negotiate because we need to get the work done. And very often there's an imbalance of power in the negotiation. So all this to say, getting more clarity from the FCC on how pole replacement costs should be allocated would be helpful. The FCC did tee up the issue in 2022, and I know there's several proposals before the commission's record that if adopted, would ensure what we consider to be a more fair distribution of pole replacement costs. And the last point I wanted to make was on state and local permitting obstacles. We see a lot of those, and this kind of links to the point that you were making before, Danielle, is we don't want the good work accomplished at the federal level to be dulled by states and municipalities and counties bringing their own set of regulations and a patchwork of different rules from county to county, from state to state. We've encountered a lot of this, and we do believe that the FCC does have the authority under Section 253 to provide guidance as to what state and local practices but either prohibit or have the effect of prohibiting the deployment. And this is very similar, as you were pointing out, to the work that the FCC did back in 2018 when then Commissioner Carr led the effort to speed up 5G wireless deployment. So this is, there's already a recipe in the books, and we would certainly encourage the FCC to replicate the work that was done in 2018, but with a focus on wireline and broadband deployment.
Absolutely. Thank you, Paul. It's definitely a big priority for us and something that we're thinking through and talking through. Jumping back to 224 for a second, can you unpack for listeners? I mean, we have some reverse preemption states, and then we have, you know, the FCC's landscape for Section 224 and just and reasonable rates. Right. We also have, like, there's another, you know, interesting twist with IOUs versus municipal utilities. Can you just unpack that a little bit? Because I do think it's a complicated regulatory landscape, depending on where you are and, you know, what poles you are potentially attaching to.
Right. So, Danielle, I've got to give you a warning. I've been in charge of our U.S. regulatory operations since September. So this is still a learning curve for me. I've had to immerse myself in the world of Article 224. But obviously, the point I'd like to make with respect to 224, especially with respect to 224C, which does give rise to this reverse preemption regime, is, again, for a smaller provider like us, This creates a lot of complications because we certainly face, in many states where we operate, we are facing different regimes, right? So essentially 224C has created a regulatory environment where nearly half the states are governed at the federal level, with the other half at the state level. And certainly this brings its lot of challenges, especially for, you know, smaller and medium players like BreezeLine that have a footprint in several states and fewer resources to ensure compliance. So I've jumped to 224C, and I know that one of your questions has to do with what legislative initiatives that could be taken by the current Congress in order to ensure that we are in a friendly environment to jumpstart and increase the speed and efficiency of broadband deployment. This is one that I would point out is we would certainly be supportive of Congress re-examining this, what I call reverse preemption regime, and determining whether it still makes sense in the current environment, especially given how the FCC has demonstrated under Trump 1 and now under Trump 2 that it's committed to facilitating broadband deployment.
Well, and to that point, go ahead. I was just going to say it's been interesting to see how states that have reverse preempted, I can't remember if it's 23 or 27, but it's a 23-27 split.
I said about half because I didn't want to.
You're right on. I know. Yeah, I had 23-27 in my brain. It's really interesting because the regulation, the detail of the regulation, the way in which states have kind of, regulated this space when they've decided to do so, it varies so dramatically from state to state. To your point, having a greater consistency would make it much easier for compliance purposes for small and large companies alike. But Caroline, go ahead.
Sorry, Daniel. I could just finish before Carolyn jumps in.
Oh, yeah.
One of the challenges as well is even those states who choose to align themselves with federal regulations, when there's a change in the federal rules, sometimes these states don't upgrade and adapt. So that's another issue that we've faced in certain instances where even a state claiming to be reflecting federal regulation doesn't necessarily do so. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Carolyn.
I was just going to say, I think, the other challenge that we see, and we're a pole owner and, also an attacher, so we sort of see both sides of the coin, though, is like the muni and co-op carve out. I do think that sometimes when you read about sort of the bad apples or like the, list of terribles and experiences folks have had, often those stories relate to munis and co-ops, and they're unfortunately, poll owners that the FCC's rules don't reach. And so it sort of is, I think those can be challenging, negotiations to undertake and to work through. I think we've certainly found that in our experience, as well. I think, not to turn this into, a great debate on poll attachment policy, because nothing can be more thrilling and fun than that. I think from our perspective, we have had some concerns about shifting poll replacement costs. I think one of them, is just sort of the economics of sort of, who needs a taller pole. Obviously, if there's a situation where a pole is failing and the utility or the pole owner is putting those costs inappropriately on the new attacher, that's a situation that should not, that should be resolved, and then the pole owner should be paying for at least the requisite portion of that pole replacement. But, our concern has been that, sort of changing the way that these financial relationships work and knowing sort of the amount of disputes that can happen in the space, while we're also at the same time trying to move forward with this major expansion of our broadband network in the US, could actually end up slowing it down. That if we create a whole new regime for how these costs are allocated, that's going to create a lot of conflict in the process. And so I know that's one practical concern we've had on that front. And I do think that there at least now, you know, we're in a situation where we have some predictability about what the infrastructure costs are going to be on a particular project. So when, you know, a carrier is, you know, bidding for a BEAD project or other infrastructure project, you know, they sort of can predict right now what those costs are going to look like and, you know, shape their bid appropriately. So, you know, I think that, but there are some interesting questions. And you know, I do think also, one thing that we hope to take advantage of, and I think is a great way to resolve some of these issues faster, rather than necessarily like defining every corner case in these relationships between pole owners and attachers, is to, you know, encourage folks to use the rapid broadband assessment team at the FCC and try to work through conflicts, quickly and resolve them, and sort of move on. And, you know, I think that's a great way too, if there are folks who are behaving unreasonably, to get them in front of a neutral party to resolve the issue.
Now, I'll jump in here. I'll circle back to pole attachments because states have been invoked here. So I'll address that a bit. But in terms of your original question, Danielle, about kind of other priorities that we may be looking at, you'd mentioned the right of way and permitting type issues, which I think is at the top of our agenda. The continuation of and the funding mechanisms for various USF programs, including the build out of broadband, is something that states have typically been very interested in. So we'll be monitoring that, the FCC and in Congress as well. With regard to pole attachments, as you said, there are the number we usually use is 24. It's 23 states plus DC have reverse preempted the federal government of taking jurisdiction on pole attachments. So I don't know. It's probably safe to say that maybe half of my members would probably be opposed to a federal preemption. But it's an issue that's difficult. The cases are not easy. We know it garners sort of an outsized amount of attention, probably at both the FCC and in the states where states have claimed that jurisdiction. I think every state has an interest in trying to make complicated cases like this less complicated. If not, I mean, one, it's good for investment. But number two, from a administration of the case standpoint, it's helpful to have regulatory streamlining as well. I think one of the things that's of concern to many of my members is with the potential amount of pole attachment cases coming at them. That's a lot of resources internally that they have to staff to deal with those kind of cases. And they'd like to have a streamlined a process as they can. Having said that, I mean, the case for having some of these decisions made locally is it is hard to think of a more sort of local critical reliability infrastructure than the electric distribution grid. And it's been core to what states have dealt with for many, many decades. So there can be, I think, a good case to be made that having a local role in that, which typically falls to the states because it's states that typically regulate investor-owned utilities. If you're going to make it locally, is to have it vested with the Public Service Commission or the Public Utility Commission. And then to Caroline's point, it is true. There's a whole sector of that then is not included because in most states, even co-ops and munis are not regulated by the state commission, and they have the carve out, of course, at the federal level. So there's kind of two issues that we're dealing with.
Well, since we're at the 15 minute mark, I just want to go ahead and call out that you can submit questions in the chat at the bottom of the screen. We will keep the conversation going, but I'll be watching the Q&A box just in case people put questions in there so that we can make sure we save some time at the end in the event that we get any questions. So you guys both talked a little bit about potential Hill fixes, legislation that may be moving. Are there other ideas that you're watching very carefully on the Hill or in state legislatures, for better or worse, things that you are incredibly supportive of that you'd like to see move on the Hill? And then, you know, same question at the state level, or things that you may not love as much moving at the state level?
Well, if I could jump in, I think, you know, the one issue I want to call out that is near and dear to my heart, and Danielle, I know the chairman has been really engaged in it as well, is the IP transition. And, you know, I think that also is a really important infrastructure issue as we think about moving off of our copper-based network and onto high-speed, you know, fiber and broadband, or high fiber and wireless networks. There's just a lot of work that needs to be done to sort of speed up the process, give carriers sort of ease the process for carriers. And then also, I think, and looking at that at the federal level, you know, Chairman Carr released a series of orders just a few weeks ago that is an amazing start in trying to speed up that process at the FCC and move the ball forward and sort of encourage the industry to move the ball forward, which I think is really important. We have also, you know, really key regulatory regimes in the states that I think we've worked in our footprint states over the last 10 plus years to try to modernize our ETC and COLA rules. I think in 20 of our 21 states, we have, you know, sort of helped work through issues with the state legislature and PUCs to take into account the competitive environment and look, you know, and sort of account for those in the regulatory regimes as we're looking at, you know, how and who's responsible for providing voice connectivity going forward. The one state you may not be shocked to hear where we are still struggling with that is California. There's a lot of work going on in that state right now, but as the current regime stands, we really, under state law, don't have a path forward to make this transition and actively move our customers off of the copper network and onto more modern networks. There's just really not a pathway defined. So I think we'll be continuing to work very closely with the CPUC and also with the state legislature to try to drive a path. But, you know, it's a huge state. There's a lot of people that live out there. There's a lot of electricity being used to continue to provide copper services to those customers. And if they have better options available to them, I think we should all be working to try to move them onto a better connection.
That's great. Thank you.
Just a couple of thoughts on Capitol Hill. NARUC itself hasn't taken a position on, for example, the BEAD program and possible changes to it. We do continue to monitor as I mentioned just briefly, the bicameral universal service working group, because, of course, that affects a number of states. You have states that have state universal service funds, so it continues to be an area of interest to us. In terms of activities that are going on at the state level, it would be very rare that NARUC itself would take a position on things that our individual members are doing, but we're always interested in innovations that may be taking place in different states. And one that I would highlight, for example, is on the pole attachment issue, is some things have been done in Maine. We're coming out of the 23 legislative session, or coming out of 23, the Maine PUC passed rules. And I think it was partly based on some legislation that it had passed there, but it created a database of pole attachments. So for the largest pole owners, there is a database now that's required that they feed information into. Those that are looking to connect on the poles then can also access that database. As part of it, there are a number of other things that the PUC is implementing to try to streamline pole attachment, including, as I understand it, a trial period for some lower rates for pole attachments, and a requirement that the PUC track and get back to the legislature on the timeline for pole attachments. So I think there's some innovative things that are happening at the state. We continue to track them, and I think they can serve as potential models for other states to streamline the sort of investment that I think all of our members want.
On my side, from the Hill perspective, I think, Danielle, that aside from the reverse preemption issue that I flagged before, we think the FCC has the tools that it needs to intervene and to ensure that infrastructure deployment can be done efficiently and effectively. As I was saying, we are seeing a regulatory creep in some of the states and localities where we're involved. We're even seeing, by talking to peers, some states or localities, when they are at the stage of negotiating franchise agreements with cable cos, they've seen some states implement these low-cost broadband requirements. And Some franchising authorities are also trying to include these in the franchise agreements themselves. So again, from our perspective, to the extent something can be done at the federal level is ensuring that the states and localities don't implement further obstacles that will raise our costs to serve Americans and provide affordable broadband and high speed and next generation services to customers, because we are seeing a lot of stuff spring up in recent months. As I said, I think BEAD might have something to do with it, where there's going to be a lot of money thrown into the arena, and some authorities are seeing ways to fulfill some revenue shortages. And we think that to the extent the FCC could intervene to ensure that we are not penalized unduly, and that the monies that we are to be allocated to broadband deployment are indeed allocated for those purposes, certainly that would help a lot.
Thank you, Paul. I know we're watching all of the low-cost broadband rates and plan requirements that are being adopted in a handful of states very closely and carefully, and trying to also understand the broader impact that some of the performance standards requirements and other state requirements have on carriers and their investment. Kind of marrying that thought with Caroline, what you were talking about earlier on copper retirement and the way that some of these requirements require companies to divest resources away from investment and away from network improvements and infrastructure deployment. We only have like 5 minutes left. I would love to hear, wish list over the next few years, most burden regulations that you guys are looking at that we have not already touched on that you think, really distract away from broadband deployment and investment in next generation networks.
Well, one thing, okay, so I'll raise this. This is something you may have teed up just a little bit, Danielle, so it got me thinking. But, and this isn't a NARUC position. This is Tony Clark, and I only mention it because I wrote about it a little bit prior in my last career when I was at the firm. But it's states, federal government, localities thinking through the issue of provider and carrier of last resort type issues that sometimes attach to the old POTS system, and how to think about those requirements in light of changes that are systemically being made across the system in a move towards fiber and broadband and an IP world. Sometimes those old statutes and rules don't quite match up with the new realities of the marketplace and the technology that's being implemented. So for me, it's something for states to look at and to think through, assess where they're at, what the stage of their network is at, and whether some of those old POTS kind of regulations, if they still make sense in the modern marketplace, and if that's having any sort of distorting impact on the investment that's getting made.
That's great. Wholeheartedly.
Yes, I was going to say, I'm sure Caroline agrees with you. I know that we do agree with you as well. And, it is time to take a fresh look at those COLR obligations at the state level. And Caroline, I'll let you respond more fully.
No, I completely agree, Tony. I think that's really important. I think for us to free up the resources that we're using right now to operate this legacy network that really nobody's using for the most part, 95% of people have moved off of, and put those resources to broadband and wireless investment would be a much better use of those funds. I also, Paul, you and Danielle just mentioned this, but I would also just call out, I think that what we are seeing in this deregulatory environment at the federal level is, states sort of trying to figure out where and how to expand their regulations over certainly VoIP and broadband, potentially also wireless services. And I think it creates not just a problematic environment where, we could be in a world where every state has different rules for providing these services, but also it really undermines the efforts at the federal level of trying to remove barriers to broadband expansion and competition. And I think, that looks like something down the road we are going to there is going to have to be some kind of resolution to that, whether that's coming out of Congress, whether it's coming out of the courts. But I just don't know that we can, we have a sustainable model right now where some of the states, especially some of the more aggressive rate regulation activities you're seeing and service quality activities you're seeing, if that's going to be able to sort of live in harmony with where the federal government is. So I do think that, you know, those things, you know, charging a $15 rate for a service that, you know, costs more than $15 to provide is not something that is going to be sustainable for broadband, and certainly is going to undermine investment. Mm-hmm. Oh, Paul, you're on mute.
Sorry. I'm in the same place. I think that we've identified a lot of the main obstacles that we would like to see addressed by the FCC and other authorities. I mean, we also welcome the current delete proceeding that's taking place and currently drafting our reply comments, and obviously any more easing of the regulatory burden at the federal level, whether it's on all in pricing rules and, you know, marketing material provisions, particularly onerous consumer broadband labels, easing reporting burdens. This is all very good, and we're all very supportive of that. I think that permitting polls, make ready costs are the biggest issues we believe that need to be tackled currently. But all these other issues that the FCC is currently addressing through the delete proceeding are also very welcome, and we are very enthusiastically participating in this proceeding.
That's great. I'm glad to hear that, Paul. I do think, you know, they are viewed inside the FCC as well as being complementary, removing forward with our infrastructure initiatives and our streamlining initiatives, as well as our delete proceeding, where we're looking at eliminating a lot of outdated, antiquated, unnecessary regulations, some of which, you know, have been sunset for over 20 years, but are still on the books. And I do think that it warrants taking a fresh look. You mentioned the broadband labels. There are a lot of things, that are kind of hanging around from the last administration that we really hope to address over the next year or two, so that we can continue to allow industry to free up resources. And, you know, once we're able to, make these reforms to the permitting process, you guys can really unleash your dollars and unleash your economic investment and connect more Americans, which is really a priority that we all share. So with that, we do not have any questions. I'll make one last call for questions. And if not, I'll turn it back to Caroline to close us out by 2:30.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Danielle. And on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our speakers for the benefit of their time and expertise today. Thank you also to the audience members who joined us. We greatly appreciate your participation. Check out our website, fedsoc.org, or follow us on all major social media platforms at FedSoc to stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars. Thank you once more for tuning in. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.